I hang it around the speaker's neck.
Should I stop?
So I think now that you're...
Yeah. Actually, before I start with my own talk, I wanted to say that next week Anton Kapustin will be talking. The title of his talk is going to be Holomorphic Topological Gauge Theory, Sigma Models and Duality. Okay. And since it's my first talk here too, I just wanted to say that I'm really happy to be here. Okay, the title of my talk is that topology and geometry of the Seebeck-Witten curve or curves. And what I want to do talk about during my talk is, first I'd like to talk a little bit as some sort of introduction about the relevance of the Seebeck-Witten curve for Donaldson theory, then I want to show you how the Seebeck-Witten curve, it's actually a family of curves, defines the Jacobian rational elliptic surface and how you can compute its signature. And then I would like to quickly talk about BPS states and what is called 1/2 BPS states and what geometric interpretation they have in terms of the Jacobian rational elliptic surface. And then last, we are talking about elliptic surfaces here, so elliptic vibrations, and you can consider the debar operator along the fiber in this vibration, and then you'll obtain a determinant line bundle of the debar operator in this elliptic vibration. And in the last part, I want to explain to you how the construction of this determinant line bundles relates to the points I made in 2 and 3. Alright, so as for the introduction, so in 1983, Donaldson started to make huge progress in the classification of four-dimensional smooth compact manifolds without boundaries, and one of the main outcomes of this whole program he carried out were the introduction of Donaldson invariants. So on a four-dimensional manifold you can define Donaldson invariants by looking at principal SU2 bundles on this manifold and then looking at connections, anti-self-dual connections on these bundles. And then under certain conditions you can define the Donaldson invariants, which are a map from the symmetric algebra of the zeros homology and the second homology of M into Q, and to pick a simple example, let's take for M CP2, and then we can describe any element in H2 by the number we get when we integrate the Kähler class over this element in H2. And then the Donaldson invariants are rational numbers which I get for polynomials of the form P to the M, S to the M. these are all rational numbers, and I actually can kind of collect all these rational numbers in a generating function, so I can write down a formal power series of this form, and then sum over n and m, and I get a generating function z. And in 1998, Billingsroot and Goetsche actually computed the first hundreds of these numbers. And just to give you a feeling how it looks like, I want you to write down just the first four terms. And to compute, and of course, four terms, to compute these numbers was highly non-trivial, even though the manifold was very simple. It's very hard to compute these manifolds. But then a lot of new development came up in physics. In particular, in 1988, Witten argued that these numbers phi are really expectation values of an n equals 2 of a twisted n equals 2 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. And then in 1994, Seiberg and Witten started their groundbreaking work on this, and one of the main results of their work was that if you look at the moduli space of vacua of this theory, which I the twisted n equals 2 super Young-Mills theory, then this moduli space decomposes into two parts. And the exciting thing is that each of these parts has a new interpretation in terms of an easier physical theory. And this allows you to write this generating function as a sum of two contributions, which correspond to the two branches. So one branch is the so-called Seiberg-Witten branch. It's connected to the computation of Seiberg-Witten invariants. And the other one is called the Coulomb branch. And the contribution here is also called the U-plane integral. And this comes again from the moduli space of an n equals 2 abelian theory, which is sometimes called in physics the low energy effective field theory. If we stick with the example of CP2, then the Fubini-Studi metric defines a metric of positive scalar curvature, and you can show that all the Seiberg-Witten contributions actually vanish. So for CP2 or CP2 blown up in a small number of points, all the Seiberg-Witten invariants, all these numbers which get increasingly more and more complicated, can be obtained from this abelian gauge theory. And finally, then, in I think it was 1996, Moore and Witten did exactly this. They obtained this U-plane integral, as a partition function of this abelian gauge theory and checked that they could easily compute all these numbers, which I started writing down on the right-hand side. And the exciting thing was that they actually could write this whole partition function as an explicit integral. So they had an explicit way of computing all these numbers. And in the description of this generating function, the U-plane integral, the Seebeck-Witten curve plays a very important role. And moreover, it appears at another point when you try to compute the Donaldson invariant of the blown-up space of a manifold. You blow up in a space in a point and then try to relate the Donaldson invariance of the new space to the Donaldson invariance of the old space, and then you'll see that all this is actually described by the Seebeck-Witten curve. All right, so let's think about, or let me tell you what the Seebeck-Witten curve is. So, but first, I should probably tell you what the work I'm going to tell you about relates to. So, it has mainly three influences, and the first influence comes from a very nice paper by Atiya from 87, which is called The Logarithm of the Dedekind Eta Function. And then, of course, a lot of input comes from the work of Seebeck-Witten, and there in particular I really like the point of view which I learned from the paper of Fried from 98, where he talked about special Kähler geometry. And then when we start talking about the determinant line bundle, we'll be facing a problem that we have to extend the D bar operator across singular fibers. And there I learned a lot from two papers. There's one by Bismuth and Bose. Unfortunately, it's in French. And then the other one by Seeley and Singer. I think they are both from 1988 and both talking about extending the D bar operator to singular surfaces. All right, so now I want to talk about how the Seebeck-Witten curve defines a Jacobian elliptic surface. So if I have a curve of genus 1 and I choose a point, I obtain an elliptic curve which I can write in Weierstrass form as all the points which satisfy this equation, where A, B are numbers and the discriminant is not equal to zero. That's a smoothness condition. And the way to think about this is that you really have two sheets here of the X space corresponding to the two solutions for this equation, plus and minus y, and these two sheets are joined along two branch cuts, so that if I go around one point, I end up on the other sheet. And how do I obtain these branch cuts? These four points are solutions of this equation where y is equal to zero. So they are located on both branch cuts, on both sheets. And I said that we have chosen a particular point on on this elliptic curve, and this point is the point at infinity. And just to make this picture, to connect it with the usual picture of the torus, you could just think about the torus where you now kind of crush these two parts, and then these two become the branch cuts connecting the two sheets, and these two parts become the two sheets. All right. So now, instead of thinking about a single a single elliptic curve, Seiberg and Witten started thinking about a family of elliptic curves parameterized by a complex number, or we could also say a family over CP1. And instead of numbers a and b, you now have rational functions on the base space CP1. And let me give you these functions. And again, as a base point in each fiber, we choose the point at infinity. And you can also compute the discriminant. Turns out, actually proportional to u squared minus 1. So such a construct where you have an elliptic fibration, each fiber is an elliptic curve in Weierstrass form, is called a Jacobian rational elliptic surface. The fact that it's rational can actually be read off from the degree of these polynomials a and b. All right, and in this picture over there, because this example is so explicit, I can actually tell you what the x-coordinates of these 3 points are, and they are this. And now you can already make an interesting observation. When you go around in the base space in a loop around u plus minus 1, the 2 points with x coordinates e1 and e2 are interchanged, whereas the third one stays invariant. And if you want to look at it from a different point of view, these points correspond to the 4 spin structures on your torus. You have 1 odd spin structure, the trivial one, which corresponds to the point at infinity, and then you have 3 even non-trivial spin structures, and you see only one of them is invariant as you go around in around the points u plus or minus 1. All right. You also can observe something else. I told you that as a smoothness condition, we required this discriminant to be not equal to 0. But now you see, as we vary u, we might very well reach points where this discriminant vanishes. And that's just the fact that our elliptic fibration might develop singular elliptic fibers. And you can already see here what happens at u plus or minus 1. The discriminant vanishes, or if you stay in this picture here, I've given you the coordinates of e1 and e2. You see, if I let u go equal to 1, these 2 points coincide. So what happens is that this torus actually develops a node. sum at u equals plus or minus 1, it develops a node. And you can also check that if you let u go to infinity, it develops a cusp. The important thing, though, is that in the 1950s, Kodaira classified all possible singular fibers which can occur in an elliptic vibration. And in this classification, that would be a simple node. This would be a singular fiber of type I4*. That doesn't mean anything, but one can read off another piece of information from this, and let me explain this to you. So in each smooth fiber, we can pick a symplectic basis of our homology such that the intersection product of the first cycle with itself is zero, and the intersection product of the two is equal to one. And now, as we go around a singular fiber, what we obtain is a family of isomorphisms of the fibers, and then we can look at the differential when we finally went around the singular fiber, and this is called the monodromy operator. It's a matrix in SL2Z which tells you how the basic cycles are transformed into each other when you go around a singular fiber. And it is in SL2Z because it respects the intersection product. So we have a representation of the base space CP1 minus after removing disks around the singular points, we have a representation of the fundamental group in SL2Z. And part of Kodaira's work was that he also showed that the type of the singular fiber classifies the monodromy matrix up to conjugation in SL2Z. And you can actually check this in this example very explicitly. The monodromy operator, when you go around the singular fibers at plus or minus 1, the matrix is conjugate to this matrix, and if you go around the singular fiber at infinity, the monodromy matrix is conjugate to t to the power of 4. So you see all these matrices lie in gamma 0 of 4, subgroup of the modular group of all the elements which are upper triangular modulo 4. In very, very early in the 60s, Meyer investigated the question how to compute the signature of a manifold which you can think of as a general elliptic vibration. And he showed that if you want to compute the signature of the total space, I don't know whether I've already defined what Z is.
It's generally
Oh. oh, I didn't realize this. Okay, the Z from now on means something different. It means the total space of our elliptic vibration, each fiber being the elliptic curve EU. And the U-plane is simply CP1 minus the three disks around the singular fibers removed. So now you see we have removed all the parts which could potentially cause any trouble. So we have a four-dimensional manifold with boundary, three-dimensional boundary, and we can ask what the signature of this manifold is. And that's actually the question Meyer asked, and it's actually a very nice article, but it's written in German. And he said, okay, you can compute the signature very easily, and it's all based on a universal function which is now called the Meyer class function, which is a function from SL2Z into Q, invariant under conjugation of elements, and he also computed certain values of this function. For example, for this generator T I mentioned here, it would be simply minus 2/3. For the function minus T to the K, it would be K over 3. I actually think I confused the signs. There's a plus here and a minus here. So he defined this universal function. That's not exciting yet, but then he computed the signature and said you can obtain the signature by simply summing up the values of the Meyer class function of the monodromy matrices of these singular fibers. So let's do that in our example. We have two nodes, and their monodromy matrix is conjugate to T, and one cusp whose monodromy matrix is conjugate to minus T4, T to the power of 4. So let's compute what we get. We get minus 2 times 2/3 plus 4/3 is equal to 0. So the construction I showed you here, the rational elliptic surface I showed you, is the Seebeck-Witten curve for what is called pure Young-Mills theory. You can also define other rational elliptic curves where you increase the field content of the theory. And what you do is you add what is called massive multiplex. So if you add NF massive multiplex, then you will still have a construction very similar to what I showed you. You will still have a Jacobian rational elliptic surface, but the structure of the singularities will change. In this case, you will have NF plus 2 nodes of type of the type we had before, and one cusp, again at infinity, of type I4 star, 4 minus NF. And again, you can compute the monodromy matrices. Here it's conjugate to T, here it's conjugate to 4 minus NF. And now for these new rational elliptic surfaces, you can compute the signature as well. And what you get is NF plus 2 nodes, which give you a contribution of minus 2/3, plus the contribution from the cusp, which is 4 minus and f over 3. And yeah, and this is just minus nf. So it's very easy to compute the signature of these rational elliptic surfaces. But one question would be the question I was interested in. What is this Meyer class function? Can I think about it more in terms of the geometry or in terms of the determinant line bundle? And it will turn out that this is actually the global anomaly of the determinant line bundle, the monodromy of the determinant line bundle. So, I'd like to move on to the second point and talk a little bit about BPS states. So, we have found an interesting description of the Seebeck-Witten curve as a rational elliptic surface. You can also think about it in terms of the universal family of elliptic curves. And then what this means is for each torus, you can think what its modular parameter is. Turns out it's in the upper half plane divided by the representation of the monodromy matrices. And now, how can we imagine each fiber? Each fiber we can imagine as a complex torus, the complex plane divided by the lattice generated by the periods. And let's say you want to switch from one picture into the other. All you have to do is explain what the coordinates x and y are in terms of that coordinate z, and they are exactly given by the Weierstrass elliptic p function and its derivative. So we can use both of these pictures, and then when this whole business started with the Seebeck-Witten curve, Witten explained that we have a very interesting structure here, which is called an algebraic integrable system. And what this means is the following. We have, first of all, z is a complex symplectic manifold, and we have a holomorphic symplectic 2 form on the total space, and with the data I gave you, it's very easy to actually write it down, what it is. It is simply du wedge dz. I mean, there's still some work you have to do. You have to show that this is globally well defined, but I'm telling you, you can check this and it works out. And then each fiber, each of these fibers EUs, are Lagrangian submanifolds. And last, the form dz wedge dz bar defines a positive polarization. The reason why I'm telling you this, this is what an algebraic integrable system is, and the reason why I'm telling you this is that it makes the description of BPS states, I would say, very nice. So, So let's think about first of the flat holomorphic line bundle on a single elliptic curve. And you can characterize such a line bundle in a very nice way. You can say it has a holomorphic section which vanishes only at one point, let's call it Q, and has only a pole at this point we talked about earlier, the base point of our elliptic curve. This is the way you can describe holomorphic flat line bundles on an elliptic curve. Now let's go to a family of elliptic curves. And then you see in each fiber, we not only have to, we know what our base point is, but we also have to say what this point Q is in each fiber where the holomorphic section vanishes. So we get a section QU of the elliptic fibration, and if you prefer to describe it in this picture in terms of the complex coordinate z on the torus in each fiber, you would write z equals to now I have to introduce some names. So omega and omega prime are the periods of your torus in each fiber, and it will become clear in a moment why I call the coefficients Ne and Nm. And right now they could be like functions depending on the variable u. We will see in a moment why and when they have to be constant. Alright, so now in terms, if you think more in terms of the holomorphic line bundle, you would like to know what the holomorphic connection of this line bundle is. And the holomorphic connection is this, where A and B are dual to the cycles in the homology alpha and beta I introduced before. So in a way, these numbers just tell you what the phase is when you go around the cycles in your fiber. So now we actually start using the structure of the algebraic integrable system. We think of this holomorphic two form as identifying the vertical one forms of our fibration with vector fields on the U plane. And the way we can say it is that when you plug in a vector field on the U plane into eta, into the holomorphic two form, then you get a vertical vector field. So in addition, you can also obtain a Kähler form on the base space on the U plane. And how do you get this Kähler form? You take the wedge product of eta and eta bar and integrate it along the fiber. That gives you a Kähler form on the base space on what I call UP. And locally in Dabu coordinates, I can always write it simply like this. And then I can define a symplectic torsion-free connection by simply demanding that the covariant derivative of these vector fields vanish. Again, I've done this locally, so I have to check that this actually extends over the whole U-plane. So what I've obtained on the U-plane is also a Kähler form, and a symplectic torsion-free connection, and this is what is called a special Kähler structure. So now I can ask what the flat sections, flat real sections of flat real vector fields look like. And having this description, I can say these locally look like like this. Again, I've just introduced functions in front of the vector fields dp and dq, but now the condition that these sections are flat requires that nm and ne are constants. And so these flat real sections is what you could call classical BPS states. And now we would like to carry out geometric quantization to get to get the quantum mechanical states. So what you have to do here is you have to check that there's a Hermitian holomorphic line bundle on the U-plane whose curvature is exactly gives you the Kähler form on the U-plane. And you can actually do that. This computation of checking that this is possible is the construction in physics, the construction of the mirror morphic, sometimes called Seebeck-Witten one form. So, and now you can impose a direct quantization condition. You can say you only want to look at the quantized states, which takes values in a charge lattice. And how can you define this for two states? You simply impose that this number has to be an integer. And this is what I would call the Dirac quantization condition. And if we know what omega is, it was simply dp batch dq. So if I take two states, s and s prime, let's compute what omega is. If I plug in these two states, I get nm and e prime minus ne times nm prime. So we see these numbers not only have to be constants, they also have to be integers. However, there's one last problem, because this has been only a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient yet, because we have only done this in one patch. So as we go from one patch to the other, they might transform in a way that you know, it doesn't define a state which is globally well defined. So let's think about this. So now, using the holomorphic two form, instead of thinking of vector fields on the U-plane, I can also think in terms of section of our elliptic vibration, as we did before. And so the question is now, is such a section well defined when I go around the singular fibers? And you see that if, for example, I pick the state corresponding to omega and I go around the singularity at u equals 1, the periods transform by this matrix. So you see omega actually transforms into omega prime plus omega. So you see that actually doesn't give a globally well-defined state, because after going around the singular fiber, I'm not where I started, even if I take take it modulo the action of the lattice, which defines the torus. But on the other hand, you can see if I had picked the state omega prime, everything would have gone well. And that is connected to what I told you about the spin structures in the beginning. This defines, this order 2 point defines an even spin structure which is not invariant under the action of gamma 0,4. And this defines the spin structure which is invariant under the action of gamma 0,4. So the well-defined quantized states are really the ones where the electric charge is a multiple, an even number, because then, you know, with the action of the lattice, it doesn't really matter, and the magnetic charge is an odd number. And so this class is called the semi-classical stable BPS states. And locally, you can integrate omega and write it as the differential of a different function u, of the differential of the function a, and it varies as we move around in our elliptic vibration, and similarly for omega prime. And this notation a and ad is the notation which is used in physics. And then you see that locally this element in the torus, because these numbers are just constant, can be written as the total derivative of something which I call capital Z, which is just the same expression as this expression, except that we have integrated the periods. I mention this because this is in physics an important quantity. This is called the central charge of the BPS state. So I've already used up a lot of time, so I won't discuss 1/2 BPS states, but it's very similar what you do in this case. So let me now move on to the connection with determinant line bundles. That's going to be the last point. Determinant line bundle. So, in each fiber, I have the bar operator, and I can form the determinant line bundle. What is the determinant line bundle of the D-bar operator? It's simply the dual of the kernel tensored with the co-kernel D-bar. So here the kernels, the kernel, if I look at this as mapping functions into 0-1 forms, the kernel are just the constant functions, and the co-kernel is dual, self-dual to the 1-0 forms, which are closed. So now I can do this construction in each fiber, and then moving along over my U-plane, I obtain a line bundle. But the point is here, and that was a very important point observed by Quillen, that if I just take the induced metric, which I get from the L2 metric on this space and L2 metric on this space, I will not obtain a smooth metric on my determinant line bundle. I have to obtain a different metric, which is called the Quillen metric. And how do you define the Quillen metric of a section? You have to multiply with the regularized determinant of the Laplacian, and this will give you the smooth metric on your determinant line bundle. So now if we take a section, we see here we have essentially the dual of the kernel times the dual of H10. So you can think of a trivializing section, an element like this, and then you can compute the Quillen metric of this section, and you'll find out, it's just a short computation, that this is actually the discriminant of the elliptic curves to the power of 212. Okay. So now, according to Quillen, if you want to compute the curvature of this determinant line bundle, what you have to compute is this quantity, the logarithm of the Quillen metric, because we assigned a new metric to it. And you see, since we have written it here as a square, it's not quite a holomorphic function in U, but it's actually a holomorphic function in tau, you see that this quantity vanishes. And so the curvature of the determinant line bundle for our Jacobian rational elliptic surface vanishes. And in physics, people would say the local anomaly vanishes. Now, we have seen like that this is a section in each fiber, and due to our holomorphic symplectic 2 form, we can actually identify this section with the section du on the u-plane. So it's just a one form on the u-plane. We can identify this section, the one form on the u-plane, which determines a canonical trivialization of the determinant line bundle. The only thing which is left to do is to observe that for the discriminant, which we computed to be essentially this quantity, that the trivializing section has a holonomy when I go around the singular fibers. So if I define a quantity, okay, now another eta, eta 0, as the holonomy as I go around a singular fiber, I have everything together to actually compute what it is. I know what delta is, I know what the Quillen metric is, and I hope I don't make any mistake now. Around u plus or minus 1, I get one third, and around infinity I get minus two third. Why do I get a minus here? So if this is the u-plane, the points at u equals 1 and u equals minus 1, these are the boundary circles around the pieces I cut out from CP1. So now if I go around the singularity at infinity, this actually means going the other way in the u-plane. So, and then looking at this expression, it's clear that, you know, this must be twice this quantity, because for big u, this behaves like u square, and why you get the minus sign. All right. So now if you think instead of the Dolbeau operator, of the signature operator in each fiber, that would be essentially two copies of the debar operator, and which means for the determinant you will just square it. So the holonomy you get for the signature operator in each fiber is going to be two-thirds around the points plus or minus 1 and minus 4/3 around the cusp at infinity. And if you compare this with what I said right in the beginning when I talked about the Meyer class function, you will see that this is exactly the Meyer class function at the monodromy matrix. As a last point, we talked about the rational elliptic surface, and I told you that over the points u plus minus 1 and infinity, the fiber becomes singular. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the manifold Z, the total space, develops a surface singularity. In fact, if you only have a node over a point, that doesn't make your total space singular. However, a cusp, the thing at infinity, there you have actually a surface singularity. But you see, for this vibration, I can actually extend it across the points plus or minus 1, at u plus or minus 1. And the same with the determinant line bundle. I just erased it, but I computed the Quillen metric of the section, and I can control the norm of the Quillen section as I get close to the singular fibers, which means that I can simply extend the determinant line bundle across the across the points u plus or minus 1. But then, because you want this equation to be still valid, so first thing is we extended the determinant line bundle extended across the points u plus or minus 1, but since we still have the monodromy around these singular fibers, what then happens is that this curvature will obtain current contributions, delta contributions to its curvature exactly at the point plus or minus 1. And that's just two descriptions of the same thing. I can either talk about monodromy around the singular fibers, or I can extend it across the singular fibers, but then the curvature, which is then also defined at these points, has to have current contributions. All right, and as the very last point I wanted to tell you about is that what we did here is that we computed the signature of the manifold of the total space Z, not the central charge or the other Zs, by a computation along the fiber. But on the other hand, if you think about the signature, even though Z is a manifold with boundary, you can use an index theorem and think of it as being computed by some characteristic class. If this would just be a four-dimensional manifold without boundary, all we had to do is take the first Hirzebruch polynomial and integrate it over the manifold. However, because we have a boundary here, there's a boundary contribution. This is a spectral invariant of the boundary. I'll talk about this in a second. Just wanted to tell you that by the same argument we have done before, the first Chern class of Z is actually the pullback of a form on the base. So this part actually vanishes, and the signature is entirely determined by the spectral invariant, the Artier-Patudi-Singer invariant on the boundary. And our boundary, in our case, has three components, three three-dimensional components. And what are these three components? They are all torus bundles over the boundary circles, which are constructed from the corresponding monodromy matrix. And now, what is this invariant? There's a self-adjoint operator on this manifold, which is the operator B star minus star B, which acts on functions of W and two forms. And This is a self-adjoint operator, but it's not positive definite. In fact, the pointwise spectrum, you get the positive eigenvalues and the negative eigenvalues. And now, similar to the zeta function, you can define an eta function by simply I'm sorry, now another eta is appearing. That seems to be the problem in this, that everything is called eta and z. And then the spectral invariant for this boundary component is eta of 0. So now we have actually found some two very interesting descriptions here. For the computation in terms of our rational elliptic surface, you can just compute the Myers invariant by the global monodromy of the signature operator along the fiber. But then, of course, this also, by the Attia-Patouli-Singer theorem, also has an interpretation from the viewpoint of the four-dimensional manifold Z with boundary W. And as a last remark, I just want to say why I'm interested in these things. And it all comes back to what I told you in the beginning, that we have this U-plane integral. And what I can do is I can show that this U-plane integral, you can actually also write it as partition function of a nonlinear heterotic sigma model, which starts on one of these elliptic fibers EU at the boundary at infinity, and has target space as 1 cross CP1. And you can compute the partition function and the generating function, and it turns out that it's exactly the U-plane integral you get for CP2 if you compute the Donaldson invariance for CP2. And so for the description of these partition functions, the whole picture I gave you with the correspondence of BPS states in terms of line bundles on the elliptic surface and the description of the D-bar operator and the determinant line bundle are very important in this description. So this is why I was interested in this description, and then actually to carry this out, you know, is some much more work you have to do, and then you find that these are equal. And I believe there should be another, like an underlying reason in string theory or something. Why? But I don't know why. I just computed that these two were actually equal. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yeah, I wonder if you can consider more singularities at finite U. I mean, I know from physics that the minimal assumption that there are only two dions at U equals plus one and minus one equals. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you prove that you cannot have more than two singularities?
So what happens? Oh, you do have more singularities. For example, if you add massive multiplets, you get much more than two singularities.
Yeah, okay. Without other multiplets. I mean, another way to ask a question. So can you prove that you cannot decompose the monodromy matrix at infinity in more than two? Of the product of more than two monodromy matrices at plus minus one other finite points, respecting this semi-classical stability conditions that you were talking about.
I mean, as soon as I have the discriminant and these polynomials given, I just know everything. I know what the singularities are I know where the singularities are, and I know by Kodaira's classification theorem what the monodromy matrices are conjugate to. So changing this also means changing the structure of these polynomials, and then you change the whole rational elliptic surface. So I'm not quite sure whether...
I guess from a physical point of view, what you have a classical moduli space where you have a singularity. And when you go to a quantum moduli space, you just guess what's the structure of a singularity at finite u.
Yeah.
But you know that since you have a singularity at infinity, you have to have some other singularity in some other place in order to have a monodromy on the singularities. And then you know that there have to be at least two, because there's this z symmetry and u goes to minus u.
Z force symmetry, actually.
But I mean, this is exactly what happens. For example, but let me come back to this case of massive multiplets, because I think there's like an interesting point in there. So, for example, for NF equals to 1, you can have three nodes and a cusp at infinity, right? And the location of these nodes is actually determined by the masses of the massive fields. Now, this is the generic case. You can make it less generic and also have a node and a singularity of type 1, 2. So then you have only two singularities, but of different type, but the singularity at infinity doesn't change. Again, the point is just how generic the zeros of your discriminants are located. Here, two of the zeros coincide. So I feel like that, yeah.
If I can just make a comment, if I understand the thrust of the question, Savergan didn't start with the family of curves.
Yeah.
Oh,
it
yeah.
Well, it started with a physical assumption.
Yeah.
And they arrived at a possible solution.
Right? Uh-huh.
Their argument that solution is the only solution is sketchy at best.
Yeah, okay, but I accept this, but I'm actually not addressing this problem of deriving it. I'm just saying, in terms, once you assume this Seiberg-Witten curve is there, and do this construction, things like the blow-up function, which you have to compute in Donaldson theory, and which, by this great paper by Fintuschel and Stern, but which is hard work, comes out like pretty natural. And I mean, it's a question where you start assuming that this is the right solution. But actually it would be interesting, I mean, for the Donaldson invariance of CP2, the Seiberg-Witten curve with no massive hypermultiplets seems to be the one that counts. What about the one with hypermultiplets? Maybe we have like a bunch of new invariants there. A lot of people always say, yeah, that could be, but nobody seems to have computed it. So one aim was actually also here to develop this machinery a little bit and then just plug in the other elliptic curves and see what invariants we get out of there. And I'm still really interested in that. But, yeah.
Off button.